Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Spill and Dish, a podcast from the Specialty Food Association. Founded in 1952, SFA is the leading trade association and source of information about the $194 billion specialty food industry. We champion the food producers, retailers, and other buyers who make up the specialty food world. If you want to know more about membership, visit specialtyfood.com. While on the site, check out the Maker Prep Course, a 12-step online program that will teach you how to take your specialty food product to the next level. In each podcast episode, we want to share the stories behind the products made and sold by our members who are helping shape the future of food. You can listen and discover the inspiration, recipe, craft, culture, ingredients, and production methods that help answer the question, what makes specialty food special? I'm today's host, Julie Gallagher, Director of Content Development at the Specialty Food Association. We're so happy to bring you today's episode and also pleased to be working with Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit podcast network covering the world of food, drink, and agriculture and expanding the way eaters think about food. Our guest today is Jen Lau of Mila, maker of authentic Chinese soup dumplings, noodles, sauces, and more. Welcome, Jen. I'm so excited to have you with me today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. Now, I must confess that in preparing for this interview, I Googled how to pronounce your company name. And surprisingly, I found a TikTok about it. So that was really convenient. And then that sent me down a whole rabbit hole, and I've been craving your dumplings ever since. So tell me, Jen, are you a third culture kid?
Yes, I'm a third culture kid, and I'm not sure if everyone knows what that means, but the way that we define it is your first culture is where your parents are from. So in this case, my parents are from China. And then your second culture is where you reside and where you've grown up. So in this case, it would be the US. And third culture is really an amalgamation of that. So you're influenced by both of these cultures, and it's a little bit of a unique space in which you're growing up.
Oh, that's great. And it seems like you're sort of tapping into those cultures with this business. So take me back to the beginning and tell me about the restaurant that started it all.
Yes. So we actually started our restaurant October 2018. And this was opened as Shaotzeje at the time. And we really wanted to just eat our favorite street foods from China that we had tasted whenever we go back to visit our parents' families. So we started with our hero product called Xinjiang Bao, which is a pan-fried soup bao. And then from there, we wanted to keep expanding other street foods. So we were open for a year and a half before COVID had hit. And during that time, we shut down for a few weeks to regroup on what we wanted to do just in case this was longer. Luckily, the restaurant was able to open again after 3 weeks and start resuming takeout and whatnot. But during those 3 weeks, we started to think about ideas and started to test frozen soup dumplings. So we started to do frozen soup dumplings, which is our main e-commerce D2C product now. And we actually started with packing it into plastic Ziploc bags in a brown paper bag and then dropping it off at people's doorsteps around where the restaurant was. So that's how we got started during that time.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. It sounds like it might have been like an all hands on deck operation at that time.
Yeah. Well, Kind of. So during that time when we were figuring out the frozen soup dumplings, it was our chef, Brian, Norman, Caleb, and myself, my co-founding team. So that's kind of what we were sorting out. And then because the restaurant actually had opened up again, they were busy with the restaurant operations. And then we started to build a lot of the different staffing and resourcing very differently for the D2C business, since that required delivery drivers, a website, ads, online social media, things like that. So totally different, I think, set of things needed from a physical operation of a restaurant.
I see. Okay. And then so recently, or maybe not so recently, you were able to raise $31 million. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you did it and what some of the challenges were?
Yeah. So we had started the D2C piece of it 2020. And then we actually had moved into our first manufacturing facility around July 2021 to manufacture our own soup dumplings in a custom space to do that. And then near the end of 2021 is when we started to receive some investor interest. So up until that point, we had bootstrapped the operations and we were seeing that there was still demand that we weren't tapping into from running some tests online, for example, and seeing that ads were performing really well. We were constantly selling out of our product. And so when the investor had reached out to us, what happened was this was Imaginary Ventures. Their friend had seen our ad on Instagram, purchased the item, tasted it, thought it was really good, sent it to our now investor, Logan. He tasted it, was like, wow, this is so good. I wonder if they have expanded things. What are they planning? So he reached out to us on Instagram, DM, hopped on a call. We told him about how we were running things. We looked probably smaller than what we were at the time because none of us knew what we were doing. And our marketing was not great. Our branding was not great. But like the product itself was really tasty, which is what won us that initial traction. So that first round was then done January 2022 with Imaginary Ventures. And a lot of that went into scaling our operations, scaling our manufacturing facility, starting to actually make our first hires and build out the team. Marketing was one of the first teams that we had built coming out of that. So that's what we did with our first round. And then our second round was January of 2023, and this was with Stripes, and they had kept in touch with us after that first round, and we just kept them updated with all of our progress over that year, and we were very regimented around, like, what are our projections, what will we hit, what are we planning to do, and making sure that we hit all those milestones along the way.
Amazing. And tell me about some of the challenges with shipping a frozen product.
Yeah. D2C. So this was very unfamiliar to us when we got started. So for the frozen soup dumplings, because we had actually started very local, for that we, you know, recommended the people that we were sending it to have a cooler on their porch, since this was still the no contact time period, and we would drop it off with ice in their cooler that they had on their porch. And then by the end of the year, we had expanded to nationwide, and we needed to actually pack it in, for example, a styrofoam box with dry ice shipping, and it needed to last 2 to 3 days so that it could reach the person and they could take it into their home during that time period. So our soup dumplings, we discovered, were actually more sensitive to melting than ice cream. And a lot of carriers and warehouses actually don't even accept ice cream because of how sensitive it is to melting. So we had to go the extreme in terms of how we set up everything. And luckily, we found partners who were willing to work with us. And what we had done with them was just, we did all of the back-end data and reporting and dashboards to show, like, okay, hey, this was packed on time. This was 2 days in transit. This was a little bit late. How do we, you know, get that rate a little bit higher? Because during this time, UPS and FedEx, they actually had taken away their guaranteed shipping timelines because they were switching from, you know, like enterprise shipping networks over to residential during COVID. And so that was a big shift for them during that time period. And so we had to basically work to expand to 5 different warehouses across the US so that we could guarantee 2-day ground shipping, which was the most reliable across the US. And then we implemented a melt-free guarantee. So if it did melt, we would replace it with no questions asked. And we felt like that was so important for the customer experience, especially if they were trying this food item for the first time ever.
Wow, that sounds kind of expensive. Can you talk a little bit about the challenges? And I'm really impressed that you were able to scale those hurdles. Can you talk about maybe like lessons learned or specific challenges related to that?
Yeah. So yes, shipping frozen food is very expensive. I don't know if any of your listeners have tried it before, but a lot of websites, they charge, let's say, anywhere between $60 to $90 for frozen food shipping on top of what the food product would actually cost. And that made it very obviously not accessible, especially if people are looking to purchase this on a more regular basis. I think people will do that for gifting purposes, but it's not, you know, ideal if you're actually trying to eat this with your family at home on a more regular basis. So in the very beginning, because we were delivering locally, those costs were a lot cheaper. And our acquisition costs online were a lot cheaper since this was the time when all advertisers had pulled off of every advertising platform. So we had, those dollars to be able to play around with that were a lot more favorable. And then as we expanded nationwide, that got very expensive. And then we ended up doing a lot of our own supplier negotiations across everything. So because we had 5 warehouses, they usually would negotiate just for their single warehouse, all of the materials, dry ice, shipping, packaging, all of that. And we ended up going across all of our warehouses and items to do more of like a nationwide negotiation for suppliers to bring the cost down. And then at the same time, since we were scaling, we just worked really hard to bring other ingredient and labor costs down as well. So that way we wouldn't have to increase prices. So during this whole time, we've only increased prices one time, and that was a pretty minor adjustment up. But outside of that, we felt like it was just very important to at least keep it at the level it was, since it's already, you know, fairly expensive as a total AOV for somebody purchasing online.
And then, so I understand that now you distribute these products through some major retailers. How did that come about? And, is it difficult to get placement in these stores?
Yeah. So for the retailers, this one is interesting. Most consumers shop for their food in a grocery store. So that's kind of the natural channel that people will end up going to for CPG products. For us, we started with D2C. That was working really well for us. I think there were a lot of questions on how this would translate for retail because soup dumplings, you know, started as at least and still probably is, I would say, a pretty niche specialty product. And so we didn't know if people understood what the product was. Did they know how to cook it? Did they have the equipment to cook it? Did they know to keep it frozen so it wouldn't melt on their way home, for example? So there were a lot of unknowns for us in translating it from D2C, where we had a really large canvas to be able to educate the consumer. And we had a lot more control over our whole network of getting it direct to the consumer. And then we also had a direct loop in asking them how things were going versus retail. You just are so much further removed from the customer. So we wanted to be very careful in our rollout and just to understand how we could de-risk some of these points. So we actually started our retail rollout last year around, let's say, May timeframe. And we really did very limited tests in the very beginning with some of our local retailers who they were very excited to partner more closely with us. So we did some demos and asked a lot of questions of people coming through of like, hey, have you had this? how would you cook it? Are there any barriers? And just like watching some of the behavior in the store to gain confidence in a larger retail rollout. And then we did do a large Costco rotation in the Bay Area and Pacific Northwest during the summertime. And all of that had gone really smoothly as well. So that just gave us a lot of confidence in laying the groundwork for further retail expansion this year. So we're expanding a lot more this year and plan to expand even more than that in 2025. But those were the questions that we wanted to get answered, along with, you know, does our packaging convey the right information? Are they going to stop while they're walking through the aisle and pick it up and understand what this product is, what they're getting, and how to, you know, cook it properly and have that good customer experience? So we gained a lot of conviction over the last year. For the retail, I think your question was also, was it hard to get into? We had a couple of retailers reach out actually starting in 2021. And they just kept asking us, like, are you ready? Are you ready? We're here once you're ready to go into retail. They had also found us on Instagram through our ads, and their chef teams had purchased the product, tasted it, and really wanted to bring it into the store. So that's kind of the best story, is where they're discovering it. They love the product and they're proactively trying to bring you in. And for us, I think we just really wanted to make sure we were doing it the right way. We understood the data, saw the data, and then we could make the right choices going from there. So we just kept them updated throughout our process of where we were at and our readiness. And then they've been good partners with us since we've launched.
That's so great. So tell me, Jen, was there a rebrand along the way as well?
Yes, we did a rename and rebrand last year in March, which is a little bit unusual. We did start thinking about the rename rebrand at the beginning of 2022. So this was before we had any real scale. It just took more than 1 year to roll out. And by that point, we had gained more skill. And then by the time of launching, a lot of people were like, you already have a brand. Why are you doing this? We're like, we didn't when we first started thinking about it. But for us, it was really important because Shaltsajia was the original name. And that means street food avenue or street food alley. And that was appropriate for what we wanted to do with a brick and mortar restaurant location. It was a local place. It was really oriented around Chinese street food in like a night market hawker stall vision. And then when we started doing soup dumplings and other items, so right now we also have noodles and sauces, and then we're rolling out with another product line at the end of this year. It just felt like that really didn't encompass our whole portfolio of products that we wanted to go into anymore. So we wanted a name that would reflect a little bit of a broader Chinese food category. Also, Shaltsajia is very like Chinese. It's very traditional Chinese. And that is also where we started. And as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the third culture aspect, we really wanted to bring that into the mix as well, because that's who we are. That's the kind of food we're excited by. And we wanted to be able to go into another category that wasn't just like classic traditional Chinese food. So we wanted a name that would embody everything that I just mentioned. And that led us down this whole exploration for what a rename and rebrand would look like now that we were expanding our reach, our audience, our product portfolio, and the types of food that we were bringing into the fold.
Okay, that makes sense. Tell me, what is next for the brand?
Yeah, so for Mila this year, we are rolling out in retailers. We're launching in Whole Foods in May, and then we're expanding in many Targets in May as well. And then we have a lot more large launches a little bit later in the summer and the fall, since some of these reset processes are, you know, one year in advance. So that's a major focus for us. We're also getting some of our products that have been on D2C retail ready. So a lot of the D2C items, we can be a little bit more liberal with some of the ingredients that we have because we're able to talk about it in a different way and produce it in a different way that isn't necessarily completely scaled or like, oh, this is now locked forever. On D2C, you can do some iterations and change some of the formulas as you get feedback. But once you go into retail, that's kind of it. it. And so I think getting to retail readiness was a big push for us. And then I mentioned we're also launching a large product line, a new product line at the end of this year. So we're gearing up for that this year.
Oh, that's exciting. I hope I'm going to check out the freezer section in my local Target to see if I can find your product because I really want to try it. So we're almost out of time, but before you go, we'd like for you to participate in our final segment called Take Five, where we ask five questions. But first, let's pause for a break.
This episode is supported by HRN Business Member, Chemists in the Kitchen by LabX. Chemists in the Kitchen is a YouTube video series by LabX, spotlighting the power of chemistry and how science and food can bring people together. In each episode, real scientists walk you through topics like making your own pickles, the chemistry behind ceviche, and much, much more. It's a love letter to science, cooking, and individuality, with some great tips on how you can apply real scientific principles to your own kitchen. Plus, it's just a lot of fun. Subscribe on YouTube to watch the entire series for free. Chemist in the Kitchen by LabX is a program of the National Academy of Sciences and supports HRN's creative educational reporting and storytelling that drive conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
Okay, here are your five questions for our final segment, Take Five. What is your favorite thing about the specialty food industry?
My favorite thing about being in the specialty food industry is that I get to taste a lot of delicious specialty foods. That is the best part.
Okay. And what's one thing that the Specialty Food Association has made easier for you as a specialty food business owner?
So our team has attended a few fancy food shows and they've got to, you know, look at all of the creative, innovative products that are there to draw inspiration on the product itself, the packaging itself, the branding, how everything is done. They've gotten to connect with a lot of other companies and buyers at these shows. So that's been really valuable to us.
Okay. And if you weren't running a business, what would you be doing?
I was in health tech before this, so most likely I would still be in that sector. But now that we've been running Mila, I think we've had a lot of ideas for other types of businesses if we ever get to do that at some point. But they're all more like passion project, small things that we would do.
Okay. And what's the one piece of advice you'd give a new food business?
I think it's to trust your customers to give you signal and feedback. We ask a lot of our customers for feedback through surveys and beta testing, for example, and they might not understand everything, but people do have some instinct on what they like. And the most important thing is that you have product market fit. So got to listen to your customers.
And how do you define specialty food?
I think specialty food is something that is not necessarily mass produced or common quite yet. I think a specialty food starts as something that is unique and differentiated, and hopefully it can make its way into mainstream as people are educated about it and adopt it more. I think there's a lot of specialty food that has changed the market landscape and trends out there. So yeah, I think unique and differentiated to begin with.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find out more about this show at specialtyfood.com and heritageradionetwork.org. And remember to follow wherever you get your podcasts. Come back often to get to know the people who are shaping the future of food. Special thanks to Jen and to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station. This is Spill and Dish, a Specialty Food Association podcast.
Spill and Dish, a Specialty Food Association podcast, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.